so as to not overrun. It's actually really interesting to listen to what has been said already this morning with Mitch, an education in grace, and then for Peter, my mind's drawing a blank. Turning aside, that's what it was. And now we're going to share exactly how God did that in my life. He gave me an education in grace and turned me aside from the way that I was going. So before we get into it, let's pray. Dear Heavenly Father, Lord, thank you for this day. Thank you for the people that are here, for giving us all, Lord, another day of life, and for choosing to be merciful with us, despite the fact that we do not deserve it. Thank you for your love and your the example that you are, Lord, of grace, and how you extend it to us constantly. Lord, please bless JC and I's time up here. Lord, help us to have wisdom about what we share, and Lord, please control our mouths, that what we say would be edifying, and that it's not just a bunch of random babbling, Lord. Thank you for this time, and it's in Jesus' name I pray. Amen. Amen. All right, so where to begin? My existence upon this earth began in 1991. And y'all know my parents, obviously, and you've seen their lives. Their example, their testimony speaks for itself. But it has been brought to my attention that it is possible that y'all think you know me, but that you don't actually know me. So I'm going to give a very brief, a very brief synopsis. I was born in 1991, and about 7 months later, or 8 months later, something like that, we moved to Panama in Central America. I lived in Panama a total, I think, of around between 17 and 19 years, total time lived down there. Not sure of the exact number, but it's something like that. And so most of my life has been in Panama still. I'm 30 now. And growing up down there, it was the thing that makes it unique. Everybody grows up somewhere, so in that sense, it's just like anybody else's life. But the thing that did make it a little bit unique was bouncing back and forth between two cultures 100% of the time. That was my life. So I was, if I'm down in Panama, I stick out like a sore thumb because I'm so white, I'm pink, and I'm 6'3", and everybody else there is not that tall, and they're not that color. But I feel more comfortable down there. I feel more comfortable in Panama. That's where I prefer to be. When I'm here in the States, I look like I fit in, so everybody thinks like, oh, he's just another dude. But I feel very out of place. I feel sort of out of sorts, and I've always felt that way. It's lessening now, which is interesting. But that's been my experience. Growing up, I heard the gospel literally 100% of the time, like almost every day. I was in stepping in and out of a Bible study that my parents were teaching, intermingled with going outside and playing and having a normal childhood, of course. And Sundays were at church, Wednesdays were at church. There were conferences, and when that wasn't going on, which was almost always, there was someone living at our house for a ministerial reason, which was great. It's a great way to grow up. Truly, I tell people this all the time, and I mean this from the bottom of my heart. I don't think you can have a better childhood. Like, I don't know how it could have been better. My parents did an amazing job of loving us, but also correcting us. Like, there was definitely a no-nonsense. Like, the line is here. It was consistent. We were disciplined if we went too far, which is exactly what you need as a kid. And I'm genuinely grateful for it. So my parents did a wonderful job. I have 5 older sisters. I don't know if everyone knows that, I guess. Is there anybody here that does not know that? There we go, Derek. I have 5 older sisters. I'm the youngest and the only boy. And again, my sisters were awesome. Like, people, every time I tell people that, they're like, oh, I'm so sorry. And I'm like, You kidding me? Having five older sisters is awesome. if they're cool, it's really great because you don't have to like shop for clothes or like cook any food ever, like at all, because they just take care of everything. And it was a really great way to grow up. I love them all dearly. So that was my experience growing up. When I was about 15, came back to the States and went to high school. And I thought that I had been saved when I was a little kid, like 7 years old. I had a salvation experience of, I prayed a prayer, basically, is what it turns out to have been. And it wasn't a genuine salvation experience, but I went on believing that it was. This led to high school, where I was obviously an unregenerate person, because at church I was the church version of myself. Barely, but I was. Passable. And then at school I was a different person. I wanted to have my cake and eat it too, and I knew that very clearly. It was an explicit thought in my mind. It wasn't like, oh, I kind of fell into bad behavior, like, darn. I was much more brazen than that. For me, it was very much, I know the gospel, I know the truth, I 100% believe that God is good, that he loves us, and that the gospel is true, but I just don't really care. I want to do what I want to do, and I want to follow the Lord, but I want to do it all on my terms. That's kind of what it wound up being. I don't know that I could have articulated every part of that, but it was very much on the forefront of my mind and not an accident. So none of my behavior was excusable in any way whatsoever. And that continued for a long time, up until the sort of the end of high school, where I had another salvation experience, which really was just, we went down to a church camp in Texas, and I got really convicted about being a pathological liar, because that's exactly what I was. I was a pathological liar. I lied about everything. And it was strange. I would lie about things that didn't matter. That's how far it had gone. I lied so much about things that did matter to conceal from my parents that I began to lie about things that didn't matter. Like, my parents would ask me where I was at a given point. I could have been like at Walmart. A totally innocuous thing, but I would have been like, oh, I'm over at, I don't know, someone's house, Kevin's house, Kevin Fagan. Like, I'm at Kevin's house, which was, I don't know why. I don't understand my own mind why I got there, but I did. And so I got convicted about that and sort of repented, I guess, at church camp. And on the way back from that church camp, I confessed a lot of things to my mom. So it was a good thing, and it was healing. It was a good moment. But again, it wasn't salvation. And then, I don't know, some more years passed. I moved back down to Panama at like 20-ish, 21 maybe. And at this point, I was a little bit more mature and not such a brazen misbehavior. I was growing up a little bit, but still I was interested in doing what I wanted and not what God wanted. And that continued all the way till 2021, I guess, last year. That was last year, right? It's 22, right? Okay. I'm like, wait, we're not in 2023 yet, are we? last year in January, which is when everything sort of culminated for me. And JC and I got married. Before I tell that story, JC and I got married just under 4 years ago. Okay. And time is a vague thing for me. I don't remember dates very well. But Jason and I got married just under 4 years ago, and the beginning of our marriage up until last January was blasé, like fine, I guess is what you could say. JC describes it as pretty terrible, which is fair from her perspective, because she was married to someone who wasn't saved, who was not a Christian. She was a Christian, and she was serious, and I was not. And that was largely because the sin that was most prevalent in my life involved content on the internet that I'm not going to go into the details of, that has a stranglehold on a lot of people. A lot of people. As a matter of fact, I would venture to say almost every man under the age of like 55 in our culture, maybe globally. Like, it's totally pervasive. And it had a control on me as well. I didn't see it that way, but that was reality. And as Charlie Ashcraft used to say, sin will take you farther than you want to go, keep you longer than you want to stay, cost you more than you want to pay. That was true. I knew that from a very young age, but it lived in my subconscious, and it was not something that I used to protect myself from bad decisions, because I was a fool. And I allowed it to grow and grow and grow and metastasize in my life. And it culminated in taking me further than I wanted to go or ever thought I would go, and manifested itself in the real world. And so my unfaithfulness to JC entered three-dimensional reality. I don't know how else to put it without being inappropriate. And I can't believe that I'm saying that. Like, it's if you had asked me if that were possible in my life, I would say no, that's not. I could never go that far. But I did. And what ensued was the worst night of my entire life. Because I think due to the faithfulness of my father and my parents, my mother, God had basically in good faith given us a spiritual protection, their kids. And I say that because that night, the experience that I had was that God took that away. And he let me see what I was choosing. He didn't beat me over the head. He didn't show me his wrath. He was actually gracious and long-suffering. But he allowed me to see what I was choosing. And he said, look, if that's where you want to go, here's what it looks like. This is what it's going to look like. And I can't explain the terror. Maybe some of you have experienced it. I don't know every one of your stories. But I was in sheer terror. So much so that I actually thought for a moment, like, I might lose my mind. I could not sleep. And I was pacing around our little Lindsay apartment like a madman. The person below us probably thought, I don't know what they thought. They thought the person upstairs was going crazy. And they were right to do so. I felt like I was going crazy. So this was a Sunday morning, and I texted Doug, and I just said, Doug, I need to talk to someone, and you're my only hope. Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi. You're my only hope. And he, as a faithful friend, he came over. And he walked in the door. I don't even remember exactly how it happened because I was essentially delirious at this point. And I broke down, completely broke down, and I told him what had happened. And I basically began blubbering and, like, crying like a child. And it just completely broke me. And Doug, I remember this. Doug did not say anything other than, he said zero words. No words were said other than, we need to pray. And if I can give one piece of advice from this whole thing, if you ever find yourself with someone who needs the Lord, what they need is to encounter the Lord, just say that. say, we need to pray. And then get on your knees with them and do what Doug did, which was beseech the Lord on my behalf. Because what I said to Doug was, I can't. I can't pray. I cannot go before the Lord in this state. Because I knew that God was holy and that I was not. I very much understood that. And I was like, I cannot approach him. So Doug prayed. And then we talked some more. And it all culminated in, after, I don't know, like an hour and a half or so, me finally saying, okay, I think I can pray. I had no idea what I was going to say or ask the Lord, but what came out of my mouth was essentially wailing, Lord, please save me. Save me from myself. Please. I know. I understand that I desperately need you. And there is no other remedy for my malady. So please save me. And he did in that moment. It was instantaneous. And so the rest of the story is a lot better. He did save me. And I didn't know exactly what to do. And I didn't understand even that I had gotten saved at that moment. Because I still thought I had been saved a long time ago and I was just a total reprobate somehow. But what had really happened is I never had gotten saved. And I got saved in that moment. So I got in the car. JC was out of town. So I got in. I didn't get in the car. I got in Doug's car because my car was in the shop. And again, as a true friend, Doug lent me his car and said, go to your wife. And I got in in Doug's car. And I drove straight down to where she was, down in South Central Texas, Fredericksburg, the Hill Country. And I was going to just show up. That was the plan. But she called a couple times because I was supposed to be on a work trip. And I wound up confessing over the phone because I couldn't not tell her what was happening. I couldn't not tell her why I was coming. And to summarize, I got there and I told JC, listen, I will stay in a motel. I will stay in a hotel. I will sleep on a cot outside. I will sleep on the ground. I will do whatever you tell me to do to be close to you and to be close to Lachlan. I will do anything that you ask of me. And I beg your forgiveness, but I will also wait for however long that takes. If you even can. And if not, I understand. And this is where the education and grace comes in. Because JC's response. So I had experienced the grace of God in asking him for salvation, him saving me. And then showed up where she was, at her parents' house. And I said, I'll go anywhere. I will do anything. And she said, you are my husband. And you will be with us in this house. And I mean, how you can have any other response other than being completely decimated by a comment like that, I don't know. But the way that I explain it to people now is I would swim across an ocean of glass for JC. I would do anything for her. And I cannot explain how grateful I am that God gave me JC despite my complete and total unworthiness of basically God's grace or anyone else's grace or a good gift from God when I was so brazenly spitting in his face. But instead of responding in out of his wrath, which would have been just, he responded out of his love, and he blessed me with JC, and he gave me Lachlan, and he helped JC to respond to me the way that she did. And then after that, he gave us Roman, and the real testimony, the testimony of my life is God is so good to us, despite everything. And it's
he deserves nothing but our complete and total submission and obedience, which is what he asks of us. He asks our obedience, and he deserves it. He has shown that he deserves it. So, that's it.
Isn't that awesome? Every time John tells that story, it just makes me cry. Not because of my part in it or anything, but just how good the Lord is. Well, if I can stop crying, we'll rewind back
rewind to
my...
1992.
The next good year. 1992 is when I was born. I grew up in Texas, and I was born into a Christian home. My parents were music leaders at a little country Baptist church, and that's where I was until the point that I got saved at the age of 7 or 8. And my story of salvation is very simple. And whenever anybody asks me about, oh, share your testimony, it's like, well, the salvation point, not to make less of it, because it's a miracle any time that the Lord chooses to interact with us at any point in our lives, whether we're and where John was and just really desperate in need of, I mean, obvious to our eyes, you know, like need of help, or a child who seemingly at that point is still pretty innocent, just has a kind of understanding of, whoa, I need something else when I, as I'm moving forward, which was kind of my case. The church that I was at, my best friend went to church with me. Her name was Haley. She's still one of my very best friends now. And we just doodle-bopped along and did everything together and played together all the time. And then Haley got saved. And I remember as a 7-year-old, thinking, oh, we're not the same anymore. Like, it just occurred to me that we're not the same. And I knew that Haley, like, if she, that whole thing that everyone was like, if you died tonight, would you go to heaven or would you not go to heaven? That kind of came into my mind. And I thought, oh, man, if something happened, like, Haley gets to go spend the rest of eternity with Jesus. And if something were to happen to me, I won't, because I haven't made that choice. I know that that's the choice that has to be made. And one night at a Wednesday night service, I'd been kind of thinking about it, and I felt the Lord just, my heart started pounding, and I knew what it was that he was asking of me so gently. Nothing obnoxious had happened. It just was, JC, I want your life. I want your soul. I want to be the king of your life. And what can you really understand at the age of 7? Not a whole lot, but I don't think need to understand the whole gamut of what that is going to require. It's just an act of obedience at whatever point that it comes for you to say, yes, Lord, okay, you can be the Lord of my life. I don't know what that's going to look like, but yes, I'm going to try to learn to die to myself and to learn your voice and to learn your ways and to learn your character and learn to become more like you. Yes, that's a decision that I can understand that much, and I can make that decision. Yes, that's what I want, because I want to be with you. And that's pretty much it. I remember walking down the aisle of the little church. They still had the call at the end with a song, and an older lady at the church, I talked to her and we prayed together and made a kind of public proclamation in front of the church that night. But and I believe that the Lord saved me then. I believe that that's when an exchange of my heart happened of, okay, I'm going to give this over to you. You know, whatever. Let's go. Let's figure it out. And we'll learn along the way. And things were relatively easy in my life still. Is this me? Up until I was like 20, I guess. So I got married. Oh, did we change this? It's okay. Huh? I don't know what he's doing. Jesus? Good? Can everybody hear me? Okay. I got married when I was 21. To a guy named Jade Bivens. He was a wonderful man of God. And for my life, at the point that I was when we got married, I had just experienced in this world kind of what John was experiencing, just pursuit and grace and mercy and true love, no matter what I had done up until that point, because I had made some kind of rancid decisions and some confusing parts of my life. And this guy who I thought, oh, he's got it all together. he loves the Lord. He's doing it right. He doesn't need to be with a lady like me, because I'm not there. I'm not that good. And it was his perspective, I guess, that kind of showed me Christ in a new way at that age, which was crucial of regardless of what I had done, he wanted me. And that is how Christ is with us, no matter what we have done. He's made us, he breathed life into you, and he wants you back for him. And he gives you the choice to do it. But that's the desire. And I experienced understanding that to a new level when I met Jade. So we got married. 6 months exactly after we got married, he was diagnosed with cancer. And 2 years of life in a hospital and kind of this tumultuous window of time, and he passed away a couple of years later. So at the age of 24, I was widowed. I had moved from Texas to be with his family in Tennessee and was just kind of lost. Like, not lost in a sense of, well, where's my life going to go? I remember the moment that Jade took his last breath. I was right there with him, and my world started spinning out of control because I truly believed that the Lord was going to heal him. Why not, right? But at that point, I remember it felt like I was coming to a fork in the road, and the Lord would say, here's how you feel, you're feeling. Here's the truth. What are you going to choose? Is your life over, or do I have more for you? Okay, God, you have more for me. And like I said earlier, the point of salvation versus sanctification through the rest is kind of more of what the story is of my relationship growing with the Lord and my understanding of who he is. So Jade's passing was another huge thing in my life, obviously, of me learning the Lord's character and his faithfulness and his provision on every front. And we could sit down over coffee sometime and I could tell you all about it. I'm not going to do it this morning, but about a year after Jade passed, I get a phone call from my friend and mentor down in Fredericksburg, Beth Ann. And she said, hey. I said, hey. She said, sorry, but you're probably going to be hearing from my cousin, my baby cousin. His name's John Creech. I don't really know him that well, but I saw him in Spain because we were there at the same time. And anyway, we ended up talking about you, and I think he's probably going to reach out. I was like, okay, thanks. Sure enough, a couple days later, I got a message from John on Instagram. He was, as John is, very blunt, said, I am. I heard about your story, heard about you from Beth Ann.
Don't want to be your friend.
He said, I am not interested in a platonic relationship with you. I want to date you because I would like to marry you. And I had never met him. I didn't even know anything about him. And I appreciated his forwardness, and I told him as much. I responded back, and I said, thanks for being clear. No. Let me be clear back. No, I'm not interested. Thank you, though. And he was like, well, you know, things carry on, and he wants to talk, and I don't want to talk. And so then began this rejection phase from JC to John for about 8 months, probably. Yes.
A little bit of the story about how we met, like the beginning of it. So she said we were in Spain. My dad and I went to Spain because I found some cheap tickets online, and I just went ahead and bought two. And I was like, yeah, why not? Let's go to Spain. That'd be fun. I didn't know who I was going to go with, so I finally reached out to my dad, and I was like, Dad, do you want to go? And he said he was going to be back in time, just in time from another trip, to go. And so he said yes. So we go to Spain. And right before we left, my cousin, the aforementioned cousin, shot me a message and said, we're going to be in Spain at the same time, I think. Which is bizarre, truly bizarre. I've never been to Spain. I've never been to Europe. I've never left the Americas. My cousin has also never been to Spain and never goes. It's not like a common thing or anything. And the fact that we were there at the same exact time was surreal. Anyway, so we decided to meet up in Barcelona and at the end of our trip. And we're riding around. She asked me about, like, how's your love life? And I was like, well, what love life? I then said to her what I said to everyone at the time, which was there were no good girls left. There are no good girls left to marry, which, I mean, at the time, that had been my experience, but ultimately was wrong because here's the evidence. She said what every woman ever said to me in response, which was, I know tons of girls. I know tons of great girls. And I was like, prove it. If that's so true, like, everybody says that. So prove it. She proceeds to tell me the story. We're riding in taxi to the next, like, I think we're going to a restaurant or something. So she proceeds to tell me the story of JC. And I was like, how JC had gotten married, how 6 months later her husband had been diagnosed with late stage cancer, how she had then decided at a very young age to stick by his side to the bitter end. And I thought, okay, that is the kind of person that you want on your team, for sure. she's probably very unattractive because people are often either really, really good people and my point is, I didn't think that she was going to be super good looking. That's not what immediately came to mind. Turns out I was wrong. I was very happy to be wrong. So I messaged her when we came back, and from there.
Thank you. So the time went on of John, I really want to date you, I really want to date you. And it was fine. I didn't mind talking to him, but I just wasn't interested. I was still living in Tennessee with Jade's parents. He was their only child, and so it was just them. And so the three of us were like the three amigos. They love the Lord. They're super, super strong Christian people and have made a huge impact on my life. And we're just close. I love being with them. And so I had chosen to stay in Tennessee. I had purchased a home there. I was starting a business there, and so I was not in a place to entertain a love life. I didn't even want to throw that into the mix of grieving with our family and trying to navigate. I mean, everybody knew, like, oh, she's 24. She's probably going to get married again and have a family. Like, that thought was there, but that's a stinger, you know, to that side of everything. So introducing that was not really on my agenda. Anyway, long story short, John was like, okay, fine. Went and dated a little bit more. Came back again and was like, look, I went on some dates and I just really wished it was you, blah, 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 blah. Really sweet, but I was like, meh, sorry about it. I'm not really interested. He said, please let me just take you on a date. So I'm not really ready to date, but good grief, if you'll leave me alone a little bit, let's go hang out for a day. That's fine. So he went and planned this big, huge, extravagant day trip to Washington, D.C. And on the plane ride over there, I said, man, this is a lot. And he said, yeah, don't get used to it. I don't really have this much money, but but I want to put myself at the front of the line of suitors for you, basically, because I'm serious. I want to marry you. And it got my attention, and I appreciated it. But still afterwards, I just saw, I mean, he was a nice guy. We had a lot in common. I have a lot of interest in actually the culture that he grew up in. And so it was fun to have conversations and talk about it. But I saw a lot in John that were red flag-ish to me. And I thought, oof, this is not for me. This is not for me. Up until the point that the Lord woke me up one night and I felt like made it clear to me that John Creech was the man that I was going to marry. And I could trust him with my heart. I could trust him with my grief. I could trust him with anything that I was going to be doing moving forward from that point on, and that he was the man that I was supposed to marry. I wasn't in love with him. I wasn't in love with John the day we got married. I kind of liked him as a friend, and that's it. And so I remember at our wedding day, the photographer is like, hug, kiss, do all these things. We're going to take pictures of you. And I was like, I'm not feeling it, lady. All right. Like, can we just...
But we are married.
Can we just sit on the porch and, you know, take some shots then? This, the intimacy of our relationship on all fronts is just needing to develop from this point on because it's not here right now. And the Lord in his goodness did just that. So like John said, when you asked me what our first little bit of marriage was like, it was awful in my opinion, because I was married to a man who was not serious about pursuing the Lord. And gentlemen, my husband said recently to a group of people we were talking to, you have a calling on your life as a spiritual leader of your home. And I think he told the guys, he goes, God didn't ask your opinion. In his goodness, he didn't ask your opinion if you wanted that role or anything. It is yours, and it is your duty to fulfill it. And not that the wives' bad attitudes or anything are dependent on that. We need to depend on the Lord and be faithful to him and what he has called us to do as women and as wives. But please hear me when I say what you do in leading your home makes such a big difference. And let me encourage you with that, not burden you with that, but encourage you by saying what you do as a man in your home, we women, the children, we depend on it. It's a lifeline for us. So please don't take it lightly. Well, my husband did take it lightly, unfortunately, at that time. And so it was just kind of chaotic for us. And I had gone down to Texas over the Christmas, New Year's time. That's when my family celebrates. My birthday is right after that. So it's kind of a fun little season. And he had to work, so he stayed back. Next thing I knew, he's on the phone with me just wailing. Well, what's wrong? Confesses to me what has happened on his end. And I guess I wasn't super shocked because I had seen some patterns, you know, of unhealthy things. But it was obviously still really bad news. So when he got to Texas, the Lord had just given me this compassion for him because I knew, too, from a prior time in my life, how badly I needed somebody to just ignore the dirt and help me. And God gave me an opportunity to do that with my husband. And it wasn't of me. I couldn't have done it. If you knew me or you were a fly on the wall in our apartment early on, I was angry. I was mean because I had things in me that I thought, I mean, this is really selfish, but I really thought a lot with John. I thought, oh, my first husband died, and now I have a healthy husband who should be able to take care of me and should be able to love me and should be able to treasure me and blah, 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 all this stuff, which he wasn't fulfilling that, but it was awful on both ends. He was not in a good place. I was not in a good place. And so the fact that the Lord extended grace to me to extend to John is another miracle. And so he showed up at my parents' house, not to mention extended grace to my mother and my father and my siblings to do the same thing. He walked in those doors to love us, to embrace us, to not push us out or push John out or try to separate us. They looked at our marriage and our family as a valuable unit and were on board to encourage keeping that, which, again, was a huge thing. So the immediate week that followed that, I think tying in the sanctification part was this raw, like, rip all the layers off. We're down to the basics and totally in need of the Lord's hand to move and to heal and to do things on John's end, on my end, to give us wisdom on how to move forward. And he did just that. And we came back and he has given us, at this point, a large community of people that know us. They know our story. They know what's going on and they can love us. But specifically at that time, he gave us friends, Doug and Amy, who took us in, and again, we're another extension of that grace and another extension of that mercy, who just took us and encouraged us and were pointed with us and saying, hey, you need to work on this. Hey, you need to work on this. They led us into their home. They let us pour all of our dirt onto their table. And to me, it was probably the first time in my life that I had seen that aspect of, I feel like, what the Lord has intended amongst all of us to do together, to bear one another's burdens and to walk in that side by side for his glory, for our healing, for all these things that he so wonderfully ordained, I guess, I don't know if that's the right word, but put in order for us to get to experience him in that way. And anyway, so that brings us up until this point. The Lord has healed and is continuing to heal our marriage, to grow us. He's given us another child. And it's just his goodness over and over and over and over and over again, which is kind of the end of the story. But that's kind of it for us. It's just the Lord is so good. He is so good, and his mercies know no end, and his richness knows no end, and my life is not a sob story. You could look at it that way. You could look at John's as another way, but the truth is the Lord has worked effectively and equally in both of our lives and in your life, if you'll let him, no matter what it is, for him to step in and set it right. I looked up the definition of sanctify on the way over here because growing up in church, I heard it a lot, but I couldn't really. If you said, JC, what does Webster say about sanctify? I'd be like, I don't know. I don't really know what the exact definition is. But the definition is to make holy or to set apart. And I thought, man, this morning in the car, riding up here, I asked John, I said, do you know what the definition of sanctify is? Of course he knew. But I thought, man, what a thing that the Lord would see fit to take us and all of our grime and everything else and to sanctify us, to make us holy. What? To set us apart. That's such an opportunity. It's not even an opportunity. It's not the right word. It's such a miraculous offer and proposal from him, of him saying, come on, come with me. Let me love you. Who could turn that down? So that's it. That's our testimony.
Thank you very much.
We're glad you joined us for our services here at Mission Boulevard Baptist Church. We look forward to having you join us again online, but you are always welcome to personally attend any of our services at the Mission Boulevard Baptist Church here in Fayetteville, Arkansas.